You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric, and today we're going to be talking with Joe Kane, who's a fellow focused on cities at the Brookings Institution, and I'm going to have him come in and do a better job of describing himself. But I found Joe as I was looking for experts who might have some examples of how we can be weaned off of cars and onto public transportation. And then Joe and I got to talking, and there was just a lot more there about cities and modernization. And so I thought, you know, there's just a wealth of information here that we could all learn about how we can improve our cities. And so, Joe, thanks a lot for being here. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're working on?
Yeah, so I think you put it pretty well, succinctly. So I work specifically at the Brookings Institution, which, if you know, listeners haven't heard of that before, it's a think tank in Washington, where I'm really kind of an economist, but also an environmental planner. And so a lot of my work looks at the intersection between our infrastructure, you know, which I think is deserving of its own definition, and economic development. So, you know, when I say infrastructure, I kind of am referring to, you know, all of our various transportation systems, as you were describing, but also our water systems, our energy systems, our broadband systems, all of the sort of physical stuff that we all depend on, that our economy depends on, that our environment depends on. You know, how those systems perform or do not perform well, you know, how federal, state, and local leaders all have a role to play in operating and maintaining and investing in those systems. And then ultimately, hopefully, how those systems can perform better for more people and places across the country. And so in as much as that I'm in Washington at the moment, you know, and very much a lot of federal attention on this issue from the Biden administration and others, you know, for example, but it's really an issue that touches every corner of the country. And, you know, a lot of my work does hopefully reflect, those concerns on the ground, that I think are pretty real and growing, every day.
So, Joe, you know, a lot of the folks who are going to be listening live in cities or near cities. Can you talk a little bit about some examples you might have, maybe not a specific city or maybe a specific city, but about the handful of things that kind of work together to create this infrastructure challenge? Because I think people feel it in obvious ways, like, is my drinking water safe? Or, oh my gosh, you know, my public transportation doesn't work. Do you have some examples of how they're working together in some different places?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, try to be optimistic about this, but it's easy to be pessimistic in some ways, depending on the particular place. You know, I think usually the high visibility infrastructure failures is what captures a lot of media attention and, you know, sort of public concern, quite frankly, here. And so, you know, years ago, if some listeners remember, you know, there was a bridge collapse in, you know, near Minneapolis, for example. You know, we've heard of issues in Jackson, Mississippi, and you know, Flint, Michigan, around our water infrastructure issues. You know, you could argue even more recently in the last few weeks, you know, in Hawaii with their, you know, wildfire risks. I mean, that has certainly you know, implications for our infrastructure, including, you know, energy infrastructure, as we've seen in other Western states too. So, you know, there are a lot of places that I think we focus on kind of the sudden or huge failures, if you will. But then there's just the daily challenges, I think, that, you know, may not get as much attention, but we all deal with as households, as businesses, in rural areas and in cities too. So, you know, you think of, if you're in, choose another city in Michigan, right? Besides Flint, choose Detroit. You know, there was coverage a few years ago on how some individuals don't have access to public transit too easily. So they have to, in some cases, walk hours to even to get to work. You know, that's very much an infrastructure challenge and failure, in my opinion, that you know, we have this transportation network built out in some places where it's just not servicing all people, or it's providing safe, affordable reliable transportation to all people. You think of broadband access, a huge challenge in many rural parts of the country, including West Virginia, for example, where they don't even have in some cases some of these these cables installed. But then you look at some major cities too, even like Los Angeles, where they don't have coverage, because of affordability concerns, where some households can't even afford broadband service, so their kids don't have the ability to learn from home, for example, or even do their homework, right? So you see sort of these stories of people going to Starbucks or or a restaurant to get Wi-Fi. So it's a combination of issues where I think transportation tends to get the most visibility just because it's just something we all deal with. We're caught in traffic or we have challenges with just getting around every day. But I like to stress that there are also less visible but persistent challenges that take hold in different places, including in water, energy, and broadband.
Yeah, so let's take those three. If I'm a city leader or a city administrator, and I'm thinking about what you're talking about, what are some of the negative implications of this? Because I think, like you said, you think about them separately. You think about transportation, you think about broadband, you understand energy and needing to switch to sustainable energy. But as a city manager or a city leader, how do I talk about the negative implications of all these things working together?
Yeah, well, it's I think first of all, it infrastructure in itself almost sounds like a technical engineering issue, and it is in many ways, but it is also a very intuitive real life challenge that we all deal with every day. And to the extent that it isn't just some issue that's handled by engineers in a back room, with their calculators and their rulers, but it is actually highly visible and prioritized by economic development officials, by political leadership, by certainly planners, myself and included in that. To the extent that these issues are being raised and elevated, I think in public discourse is really important. To the extent that they are connected to issues of environmental sustainability, economic equity, and affordability. These are again not just sort of mathematical equations to solve. And I think there's open questions of, well, are we even measuring these needs appropriately? Who is measuring these needs? Are investments being targeted effectively? Because in the United States anyway, just very generally, I mean, we are operating still off a 1950s era vision of infrastructure, I would argue, where at that time the goal was just building a bunch of new stuff. So, building new highways, building new pipes, really expanding. And that's true in some parts of the country, but in many cases, our infrastructure is built out. And as engineers like to call it, it's kind of at the end of its useful life, or it needs repair and replacement. And so I still think there's the public fascination with, well, the ribbon cuttings, right? And the new bridge that's going to open, and new infrastructure is certainly needed in some cases, but we don't often have, ribbon cuttings at, repairing a pipe or paving over a road.
It
But those
comes
are
with headaches.
the vast majority of the projects that do need to happen.
Well, in fact, a lot of those projects come with headaches for people because they're inconvenienced by having to drive around or sit in traffic. A lot of what we're left with is antiquated infrastructure. And so, if I'm, again, a city or a community, just a regular person, how should I be thinking about changing and improving? Because, like you said, people don't always know, is my broadband fast enough? They just know when it's slow. Same thing with something like water. A lot of people have water filters now, so they think that gets a lot of the pipes. How should folks be thinking about prioritizing, getting their head around just improvements?
Well, I mean, building as we're having this conversation here, I mean, just getting it on people's radars as, public awareness in some ways is lacking in a lot of places. And we all, Eric, you and I included, and others listening in, I mean, we're all users of these systems. And so to the extent that our use of these systems places stress on them, but then we also demand, a lot of these systems. I mean, that's something that you know, a local water utility, a local transportation department, I mean, they're not blind to. I think that, you know, the challenge for them is often it comes down to, you know, the elephant in the room is money. You know, where is the money going to come from to really accelerate some of these repairs, you know, identify and target those improvements where they are most needed. You know, and fortunately, you know, there's an opportunity now with the passage of some pretty historic, you know, federal legislation on infrastructure where some of those local entities are going to get a little more capacity to do these projects that have been, you know, festering for decades. I mean, this isn't just something that's just we woke up to today or in the last few years. I mean, these are challenges that have persisted for some time. And if anything, a lot of places have kicked the can, you know, and kind of, as I like to say, you know, wadded up the chewing gum and put the duct tape on it just to keep things going. And that's just not sustainable long term. And so, you know, unfortunately there are inconveniences in those repairs. And but I think the hope is that by doing hopefully more durable repairs and future looking technologies and you know, more sustainable, resilient designs and like, you know, these systems will perform better and more cost effectively over time and provide more certainty because they were not designed originally. Again, if they were built in the 1950s or even earlier, I mean, some of our water pipes are even from the 1800s still, actually. You know, there are still wooden pipes actually in some cities, which is crazy. You know, these systems were not designed, quite frankly, to handle some of the population increases, some of the development increases. And now some of the environmental extremes that we're seeing, they just weren't designed to handle all of that. So we're kind of at a necessary inflection point where a lot of the onus does fall on local leaders being kind of the owners and operators of these systems. But there is, I think, potential given, you know, the role of federal and state leaders to provide some of that funding and some of that capacity.
So, based on your experience, as you look across the country, do you have any idea if you could rank the top one to five types of infrastructure, types of improvements that you're thinking are going to need to take place? I know that's hard because every city is probably different, but what are some of the things that you're seeing come up most often?
Yeah, I mean, I the way I think about it, Eric, is less, you know, because kind of like, well, should we do transportation versus water, right? And it's kind of apples and oranges. I mean, we kind of need to do it all. It's not like it's an option to be like, yeah, we don't need to do water. Let's just do transportation. We need all these systems really to survive and to thrive. So, I tend to think of like across all of these systems, what are some of the cross-cutting, you know, priorities and sort of future looking investments that need to happen. And I think, you know, some of these are going to happen regardless of the intentionality, by the way, of leaders or residents to prioritize them. I mean, the fact that I think number one, the fact that there are all these new technologies, you know, coming online. You hear about electric vehicles. You know, see, you know, if you're in some cities, you see scooters and sort of micro mobility happening. I mean, these are in some cases, you know, private sector innovations that the public sector has to, you know, kind of incorporate and handle. So I think, you know, there's disruption in that, you know, in that there's uncertainty and whether, you know, we're not just sort of putting these new technologies in a vacuum. I mean, we're kind of having to reinvent and rethink kind of how our current systems operate. So I think the role of technology is huge, and that's something that I think has to be prioritized across all of these systems and is in certain ways. I think, you know, two, I would put as, you know, again, climate and environmental issues. I think again, the reality that our pipes, our roads, you know, our bridges, our dams, you know, I feel like every month now or every week we almost have a new headline of some sort of failure or challenge dealing with flooding or fire risk or heat stress or you know, you name it, freezing even in Texas a couple years ago. So like, yeah, the reality that our environment is not really waiting. For places to necessarily plan. And so it's up to places to be proactive about those investments in ways that do incorporate more resilient designs, I think is really important. And then I won't go with five, but maybe I'll go with three. My third is just sort of less on the physical sort of dimensions of this, of yes, there's new technologies. Yes, there's you know, climate sort of related improvements that need to happen. But we need to fundamentally, like planners and policymakers need to fundamentally rethink even how do we measure these needs, right? Like the reality that we're gonna, build something, like set it and forget it for the next like 30, 40, 50 years, that's just probably not reality. And so there has to be some level of, I think, nimbleness and proactiveness to how we can stay ahead of and measure these needs. And so there is new data, there is new information coming out to better measure, right? Like, can people, the idea of transportation accessibility, can people easily reach, their workplace? Can they get to the store? Can they get to the hospital? Can they get their kids to school easily? Like, traditionally, we never used to have information on that. But if you're carrying a smartphone with you, for example, and you're using GPS, I mean, I don't mean to scare people, but like that's creating a bunch of data, that can, I think, have questionable means, but also can inform some of these efforts of, well, for the first time, we understand where people are going, why they're going, at what time of day. That has different demands on our transportation system. So like there's new information coming online all the time here. And so I as a researcher, am very interested in kind of, how do we better measure these needs, so that we can not just throw more money at the problem, but hopefully throw money at projects that will make a difference.
Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges you see in each of these areas to actually getting to modernization.
Often it comes down to the capacity of local places to do all of this. And by capacity, I think there's a few ways to kind of define that. So I think there's the literal just sort of technical capacity is does a city have the understanding or even ability to consider new approaches? Many cities are staffed by planners, engineers, leaders that have been doing things the same way for 30, 40, 50 years. That's how they're trained. That's how our systems are set up. They're very regimented, very traditional, very siloed. And so it can be a challenge, technically there's a lack of awareness really of, well, where do I even start? I understand that there's this new data. I don't even have a, data analyst on staff to do this. Like, I don't even know how to consider a new design. So there's partly sort of a technical capacity sort of limit here. I think there's linked to that as I'm kind of already getting into, but sort of a programmatic or staffing capacity. So an area of work that I focus a lot on is sort of the workforce of that handles all of our infrastructure. And a lot of people think of, infrastructure workers as just being sort of construction workers. You see sort of people on the side of the road with those orange vests, and you think, well, that's it. Those are all the workers in infrastructure. It's, well, yeah, there are construction workers, but then think of all the workers who might be in a water treatment plant. Think of the workers who might be in a warehouse facility. Think of all the managerial and human resources and customer service staff, in a utility. Like there's a wide range of individuals involved here, and in many cases, there are not enough workers in this space. Many of these workers are aging, retiring, just not filling these jobs because, well, a lot of them have depended on the skilled trades, and there just hasn't been as much of an emphasis on that, at least nationally in recent decades. And so there's very much a brain drain and a sort of an empty pipeline for these careers. And so if you don't have people to actually pilot and manage these improvements, I mean, that is a big challenge. And then, yeah, I mean, I think last but not least is, of course, the funding, of, well, you can say you want to do all this stuff, and you can may even have awesome, community dialogues and plans on the book saying you're going to do all of this, but you may not have the literal revenue, you may not have the funding, durable funding, to do all of this. I mean, and that's a question even now facing a lot of cities where, yes, over the next 5 years in particular, there's a lot of federal funding, extra federal funding coming towards these projects, but that's not infinite. And at the conclusion of those 5 years, I mean, places are going to have these same questions as they were dealing with before of, well, how are we going to do all of this? Because we can't just keep raising rates. We can't keep raising tolls. Like, that there can't be, there has to be an end to this. So, yet there's a need to continue investing. So the funding side of it is also important. So I would just point, I guess, Eric, to those three components of technical, programmatic, and financial capacity at a local level are really common and can be a common challenge across many places.
One of the things that strikes me is there's such a broad range of things. You've talked about, in the last just couple sentences, you talked about the need for data analysts and you talked about smart technology. That's a very different type of skill set than the folks we see on the construction crews and things like that. So help people expand their own thinking about getting to modernization and getting to things like climate resilience, because we often don't even think ourselves, oh, we've got the, we think in terms of the folks we're used to seeing, which are truly, you know, construction workers, people working on energy lines. And it almost sounds like you're saying we have to modernize how we think about that.
Well, look, the nature of the work is changing, is the reality of it. And so to the extent that, yes, there are construction laborers and there are water treatment operators and there are engineers, like, yeah, all those people and positions are required, but the nature of the work they're carrying out, the skills that are required to do that work are changing. Given, again, as I was saying before, kind of these new technologies coming online, there's, you know, a lot of people talk about automation. Hear about automated vehicles, you hear about electric vehicles, you know, those are coming through in fits and starts, but they're changing kind of the type of work, the type of facilities that are going to be needed. And that naturally is by extension changes the nature of the work and the skills required for that work. And so, you know, maybe 20 years ago, right? Like if you were a construction laborer, I'm guessing you used maybe a little different equipment than you do today. There might be more familiarity required with certain digital technologies. This is certainly the case for some environmental engineers and other staff out in the field, you know, measuring these issues, like for good reason. I mean, we have better information at our disposal now. You know, the question is though, even if we have that, those technologies and those possibilities in front of us, like, do people actually have the training? Do they have the education? Do they have the work experience, the on-the-job training needed to do all of this? Because you know, you don't necessarily need an advanced degree to fill many of these positions. Now, obviously, if you're going to be an engineer and or a manager or some other position, of course, like, there are higher educational requirements for those roles, but for the vast majority of our workforce in this space, I mean, usually there's just a need for a certification or a license, sort of, and more importantly, sort of that applied, you know, work-based learning. And so it's on the employers in particular, yes, community colleges, yes, schools, yes, even, you know, labor groups and community organizations, but really employers, like, what are the transportation departments? Like, what are the contractors? Like, what are all these employers doing to actually provide the opportunities for these workers? And unfortunately, again, you know, business as usual here is, well, let's just do the same thing we've been doing forever, you know, and just keep building more roads, keep, you know, designing our facilities the same way, keep repairing the same pipes. And then it's, I think, what's the definition of insanity? Just doing the same thing over and over again without rethinking kind of what you're doing. But that's not really an exaggeration in many cases of how we're thinking of these workforce issues.
To what degree are businesses and even cities aware of these problems? And here's what I'm getting at is you talked a little bit about new technologies and everything smart and sensory, and it can give you real-time information and you can adapt and change. And so are there companies, organizations out there that are aware of things like climate resilience and the need for infrastructure? And are they bumping into this in the cities, the city governments?
Yeah, well cities are happy. You're right. I mean, in the sense that cities are having a hard enough time just doing what they usually do, which is scary, right? That like they can't even keep up with business as usual, let alone rethink how they're going to do their business and then train workers to try it differently. The reality in most places is they're barely keeping their heads above water on these issues, as we see every day. It's like we barely, you know, are staying ahead of the needed repairs, let alone proactively, you know, redesigning or taking on new projects. And the shame of it is it's kind of what I would call the usual suspects of you know, the places that have more financial capacity, have bigger staff, that have more proactive plans on the book. So, you know, I'd include, you know, like Seattle and, you know, Boston and like fast growing, like sort of superstar metros. Like, I'm not overly concerned with them. I mean, yes, they have their own challenges, don't get me wrong, especially on equity issues and other performance issues, but like most places, like, you know, are not, they do not have the ability to think that far ahead. They're more on an annual basis coming up with their plans. They have a backlog of projects they have to contend with. And then, you know, when they do those projects, not to get too wonky, but like they deal with what's known as procurement, you know, where they work with the same sort of contractors. They only know how to use the same sort of project designs. Like they have a hard enough time just doing what they're doing, let alone like rethinking what they do. And I think that's part of the hope anyway with some of this federal funding is, well, okay, well, if you're able to loosen your belt a little bit, you know, because you have an extra zero or two on your budget for the next few years, isn't this the opportunity to rethink a little bit what you're doing? Not just to throw that money towards the same old stuff, which again, like places are going to do, and it's not that that's all bad because that's needed, but like, can they use a little bit of it to sort of think ahead on these issues? Because there's no guarantee that we're going to get an infusion like this, at least federally, and again anytime soon. And so, you know, that's where my work has really been centered, both on the workforce side, but also just on, you know, project development is just, well, like if places are struggling just to do business as usual, how can they break free from that business as usual mindset?
What is the role of state funding in this, if any? Because one of the things I wondered is you've got your local tax base and federal, but you're almost always there's funding available at the state level. Is that a barrier or how does that work?
States are hugely important. So, you know, I think most of us look towards, well, we think this is a huge national challenge, which it is. And thus, like, it's just like the federal government doing everything. But as we're talking about here, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, federal government has a role in providing funding and also, you know, regulation on some of this stuff when you think of EPA, for example. But really, at the end of the day, it's about local governments and cities kind of doing this stuff because they're the ones on the ground, like, every day contending with these issues. So they are our primary owners and operators. You know, a statistic I like to cite from the Congressional Budget Office is that more than three quarters of our public spending on infrastructure each year is at a local level. But that does also entail huge state responsibility. So the state, be it a state Department of Transportation, a state Department of Environment, they're in some ways kind of a middleman between the federal and local government, where the federal government in some cases does send money directly to cities, but in many cases the federal government, when they're spending money on infrastructure, it first has to pass through the state, and then the state has huge say over where that money goes. So even if there is a demand in a city of like, well, we need this money to do these projects, like some of that money is contingent on, well, the state agree with you? Is that falling in the state's, quite frankly, political priorities at the moment? And you know, state departments of transportation, as just one example, are a huge, hugely bureaucratic, in my opinion, hugely bureaucratic, hierarchical organizations that are designed primarily to you know, maintain our highways and roads, and often haven't had a reputation for doing, you know, a bunch of other things beyond that. I mean, so it's like, you know, transit, you think, right? Or public transportation is somewhat of a casualty in my opinion in some of this. But the states are hugely important in setting strategic priorities in making sure this funding goes to projects of need. And that's something that a lot of people, when they're, you know, electing their next governor or they're thinking of, you know, I don't think a lot of people probably even follow much that's going through the state legislature, but like that really matters for local infrastructure, particularly local infrastructure funding and project.
What happens if we don't modernize?
Well, I think we're already seeing that a little bit. It's kind of what we don't modernize is kind of, you know, do nothing.
I just wonder if a lot of the funding that we're going to see is going to go to roads and bridges. And I actually just read an article that a lot of the energy companies are already making their stations, their power stations, more resilient to climate change. So they're doing that. And I just worry a little bit about we're not going to get to broadband. We're not going to get to smart cars or smart transportation. What are the risks of not modernizing?
Well, I think I'll say also, like, the market, the private market that is, and the demand of consumers going out and getting some of these new types of vehicles, needing charging stations, like some of this, the market is going to nudge anyway, like regardless of the inaction. So, and we're seeing that to, I think, to a certain extent. I think the challenge is it's usually people of economic means, right? Like, are the ones that are able to navigate this, where like you have a Tesla, like A, you can afford a Tesla, and B, you can afford to charge it at home, right? Like, that is not the case for most Americans, but yet, like, that's like what's happening right now is kind of people who have their own means are kind of navigating this, and that's just not going to be the grand solution. I think there's a combination. I like to think of terms of carrots and sticks, right? So like, you know, there's certain, I think, regulatory measures that the federal government has already put down in a good way, in the sense of, you know, we need clean, you know, water, we need cleaner air, we need more resilient, you know, improvements. If you're even going to be eligible to get some federal money, you have to demonstrate that you're doing some of this. So like, you know, there's a little bit of like, hey, you got to do this. It isn't just like a nice to do, it's a must do. But then I think the incentives, you know, the carrots are there too, where if places are not doing some of these forward-looking improvements, they're actually leaving money on the table from both the private sector, I would argue, but also from the federal government. So there's a lot of new competitive money that's coming out of Washington at the moment, where you know, the U.S. Department of Transportation has over $100 billion, with not an M but a B, $100 billion in competitive money, where, as that kind of implies, they will competitively select based on applications from local and state governments, like, and other entities, like how they're going to be doing some of these improvements. And so places that are not doing this, that are not putting plans on the books, that are not, you know, forging new collaborations or trusting new things, like, they're potentially passing up millions, if not billions, of dollars. So it's I would argue prudent of them, given the moment we're in, for them to do that. But I think, you know, reality again in many cases is like they're not doing it, and as a result, they're not only missing out on potential new money, but they're also leading to additional costs and additional uncertainties as well.
So, Joe, you just brought up maybe a fourth thing that I'm thinking about, which is resistance to change, or maybe just passive resistance to change. So, because you talked about know-how and technology, and you talked about, you know, the people and training, and you talked about funding, and you've kind of layered in this idea of just inaction, just passive inaction. When you think about some of the challenges, which ones worry you most about, you know, cities being able to change?
Well, the ones that have the biggest price tags tend to be a problem. So you can look up, there are surveys run by, for example, the National League of Cities and the National Association of Counties, and you know, others that are really have a pull, you know, a feel on the pulse of like where city finances exist on this stuff. Because a lot of mayors look at their infrastructure as another cost item, unfortunately, or a big budget line item, which it is. And usually, you know, transportation is a big part of that, but one that I often hear a lot about and that I'm involved in is water infrastructure. So pipe replacement, stormwater issues. It's again out of sight, out of mind. A lot of people don't think about it until, you know, there is a major flood or you have a situation, you know, like that unfolded in Jackson or Flint, or, you know, those are extreme examples. But like, there are a lot of communities across the country that have very old pipes that have aging water systems, and they're huge, huge costs that are hitting or about to hit cities' budgets. And so, you know, I usually don't like to, again, do, because it's apples and oranges of, well, you got to do transportation or water or, you know, or broadband. I mean, I think it's all, you need to do all the above. what we've heard on the research side anyway, of from communities across the country, their number one challenge is tends to be around water infrastructure and repairing and replacing pipes and other facilities. And there just hasn't, I like to call water infrastructure kind of as the redheaded stepchild of infrastructure. If we don't pay attention to infrastructure, period, we especially do not pay attention to our water infrastructure in many cases. And that's borne out through how we fund it. You know, the federal government provides, I said before, it's about three quarters is local public spending on all infrastructure. It's 90% for water infrastructure. So it's like The huge weight that is on cities to pay for all of their water infrastructure needs is enormous, and it is not an option, right? Like if you don't have water or you can't treat it, like you literally cannot have human civilization. So it's not like an option not to do this. And the federal government just traditionally has not provided a lot of money for this. So and they're not even providing that much money in the grand scheme of things in this new push, you know, over the next few years. So I at least am worried of what's going to happen here. And to the extent that it's also related to some of those climate challenges we were discussing before, greenhouse gas emissions and renewable energy is really important for that. But I think we're recognizing more broadly that our water is a huge climate challenge too, and both in the sense that we have maybe too much of it or too much flooding, or you look further west and you have, you know, droughts and other concerns here too. So that's one area, Eric, that I would point to.
So, Joe, as you think about ways of addressing the complexity of modernizing cities and modernizing our infrastructure in the United States, what are some of the things that come to mind that folks should be doing or that are going on to improve the situation?
I always start, you know, it's easy to start with the dollar signs and the money, but I like to say, well, you can't just start with the dollar signs. You have to start with what are the outcomes you hope to achieve, right? And I think the recognition that our current systems are not often reliable, they're not affordable in many cases. In many cases, they're actually outright dangerous. Or, you know, people have real safety challenges, particularly with our transportation systems, where they're, you know, think of how many places there may not even be a crosswalk or a safe bus shelter. I think it's kind of a recognition that our current systems are not working well, and that the systems, or I should say the plans and programs we have in place to support those systems, you know, they need to change, or they, you know, they're not really producing, you know, improvements that we would hope to see. So it has to start with clearer articulated outcomes of, well, we want to have a system that is more in the 21st century, not necessarily the 1950s. Although I don't think in the 1950s they wanted people to be unsafe and not have affordable water. I just think they couldn't envision probably some of these challenges that we're facing right now. Yeah, it has to start there. And I think, you know, again, some cities and some states and federal leaders too are I think more clearly charting, you know, what are their aspirations? You know, what do they want their infrastructure to do for them? It shouldn't just be seen as a burden and another problem to solve, right? And you know, it's sad, I think, that we've kind of ended up that way across the country, that it's, you know, because in as much as infrastructure can be a barrier, it can be very much I like to say a bridge, you know, to opportunity, and it can make people's lives better. But if you do it wrong, then it really can, it's built in place and it can really prevent some of those opportunities. So I start with clearer outcomes, clearer plans. There's several places I can point to in that respect, Eric. But I think based on that, you know, I think an insight towards experimentation, you know, that well, we're not just going to do the same projects over and over and over again. That we will actually potentially risk, you know, spending a little more money up front, you know, to try a new design, to try a new technology, in the hopes that will make it the situation better. Is that without risk? No, but like you have to start somewhere. And then I would of course then go with, you know, show me the money, right? Like, I mean, that there is of course again the sort of the federal funding coming down on some of this stuff, but where we have seen places I think have that greater ingenuity and that greater step toward experimentation is they have had durable funding to pilot and to try some of these new things. And so, you know, just one example, like Denver, Colorado, you know, they have what's known as a climate protection fund, which is a $40 million annual effort that's aimed towards building greater resilience and sustainability for their current infrastructure systems, and tries to identify clear projects that will make a difference in that on that front. But they have $40 million each year because they have a very small incremental sales tax, you know, that so I think it's like a fraction of a percent of every dollar that they get for sales tax goes to help support this. And so I'm not saying places just need to, you know, need to raise taxes, but at the end of the day, the money does have to come from somewhere. Even if it's coming federally, that money is often coming from our own pockets. And where we have seen, I think, more movement in recent years is ballot referenda. So, you know, when there is an election in the fall, yes, you're electing certain candidates, but you'll often see referenda of like, hey, do I support a sales tax increase to improve our transportation, for example? Like, we've seen those in most, I think it's about three quarters of all cases, at least for transportation, passing. So like when you put these measures in front of voters, they are saying, yeah, I support this. Like, and we've seen this from anywhere from Atlanta to Los Angeles, where huge ballot referenda have passed to help support some improvements in years to come. So that provides a more durable revenue source rather than, I think, you know, the current sort of approach in many places is we're kind of, you know, we're leapfrogging from one crisis to the next, and we don't really have that sustainable pot of money to really try new things.
One thing you bring up that I think is really instructive is you hear a lot in business, people talk about don't be afraid to fail or innovate and things like that. And that mentality doesn't seem to always exist in cities and city management. That's the first thing. And the second thing is you need consumers on board. For folks who are listening, why should I get excited about my taxes changing to innovate or modernize my city? What benefit am I going to get?
Well, I think the reality right now is you're going to pay one way or the other. And it's almost like with health, like, I don't mean to make this pure connection, but like healthcare, right? Like, are you going to have a better diet and like, you know, reduce your medical costs ongoing? Or are you going to have the major problem and have to go to the hospital and have a huge bill to foot? So like the bill is due regardless. Like, and it's a question is like, do we hope to live healthier, better lives by, you know, being more diligent and proactive about some of these things, or do we want to just keep kicking the can and wait for disaster to hit and then, you know, potentially have irreparable like damage that we can never get back? So it's I to me it's not really an either or. It's more a question of, well, the reality is in front of us anyway. And you know, I at least, you know, think quality of life matters. I think, you know, safety, sustainability, these are all public essential needs for everyone. It's not like, well, you know, I'm not going to choose to have clean water or like, or no, I actually, I don't need to, you know, we don't need to repair this bridge. I you know, and the shame of it is most people don't even have that choice to make is the thing. Like most people can't. There are a lot of people in this country who cannot afford a car, or if they have a car, it's, you know, they're paying huge loans on them, insurance costs, parking costs. There are a lot of people that are subjected to our infrastructure failures that have no choice but to absorb and deal with them. And that's the ultimate tragedy, right? Is that like, if you have a choice, you know, and I think most people, their choice is, well, I'm going to try to bypass the problem. It's like, well, I'll just get a nicer car or choose a different route or pay this toll to go this better way or. And that's great, but like, you know, that's not sustainable either. And it speaks to, I think, some of the inequities, quite frankly, in our economy at the moment, and that are literally coded and built into our physical environment that we all must navigate every day. So I think the bill is due, Eric, regardless. And I think the question is, do we see these as a public good? Do we want to make these continual investments, hopefully, in service of not just a better future, but a better now? I think that's got to be the hope.
So if I'm a city planner or even a citizen, how do I go about prioritizing? How do I think this through? I've got a limited amount of money, and you brought up the fact that I may not have a workforce who can do all the, that may not be as technologically advanced, but I need the people I've got now to take care of my basic operations. How do I think about prioritizing, putting together a plan, and modernizing?
Yeah, well, a lot of places already have plans, right? So it isn't so much the need as just to create a plan for planning's sake, right? Like, as much as I'm sure planners, it's in the name of their job title, like that they just create more plans. But I think there's an eagerness and really a hunger in many places. How do we move from plans to implementation? You know, so we have all these plans. We can talk about this stuff till we're blue in the face, like. But like, how do we actually prioritize and just get stuff done? And I think that's a reasonable expectation. Like, we're all putting a lot of money into this, whether we realize it or not. Like when we're driving on roads and we're like, wow, this is free. I don't have to pay anything. It's like, well, we're all paying for it in some way. Like, right? Like it's more like, how do cities, I think, make that step from planning to implementation more effectively? Because in many cases, even the most, I would consider like the usual suspects of places that have been doing forward-looking planning on some of this stuff. So like Portland, Oregon, for example, comes to mind in a lot of cases, and other places across the country. Like they have tons of plans. They have like 30 years worth of plans, and yet even they still struggle with these challenges. And so what I've heard more recently is an appetite for how do we move in this sort of evolution from planning just to like implementation, and can we make not like big bets, but can we like make reasonable, like discrete, like priorities of like, let's just try to knock out these things so we're going to actually see progress hopefully
Right.
in the next few years. And then how do we hold ourselves accountable to that? Because I think you can't just have aspirations that are totally, disconnected from reality and say, well, we're going to have flying cars in like 5 years. Like that's just not happening. So like, what's our starting point now? And this is where I think some of the data comes in, right? Like, how do we create public transparency of like, we didn't hit the target, right? And we need to own up to that. Like, versus like right now, which is like, there's very little transparency. There are all these delays in some cases, total lack of public knowledge of what's going on, except there's like a disruption to my commute or something. Like, there needs to be more visibility and accountability. And I think that comes with clear data and information of just, well, how fast are we moving on some of these issues?
To what degree do you think that city leadership is prepared to do that? Because you're talking about really changing the way things have always been done. Meaning, I just do my job. I don't need to send out communications or update. I just need to tell people the road's going to be closed from this date to that date. I just need to say, we're going to be working on the water pipes from this day to that date. Not asking for input necessarily, things like that. How do you change that kind of mentality?
Well, we've seen this a little bit. So like even where I am in Washington, not on the federal side, but the District of Columbia government, for example, like DC Water, the utility here, has various educational campaigns, but also does a lot of community engagement, where they tell people like, this is where your rate is going. Like these are the amount of projects we've done. These are the projects we're going to be working on. This is how much they cost. Oh, and by the way, like we need workers to do these projects, and we want to connect with you if you or someone wants to be involved in like we are all active, not just users, but like participants in this grand like infrastructure experiment we have in front of us, whether we realize it or not. And part of that is I think being obviously directly engaged as a worker in this, but also just having awareness of what's happening. And there is some of that happening in different places, DC Water being one of them that I'm familiar with. But I think it comes to proof in the pudding of are places getting stuff done or are they not? And some of that is within their control, I would argue. Again, like a lot of these are the onus is on the shoulders of a local transportation department and a local planning staff to actually like release these budgets to be transparent, to be visible, to be proactive, not just sort of demanding of people of what they should be doing. But then it is a shared challenge and opportunity, as we were discussing before, Eric, where some of this is outside their hands of like to what extent is the state involved in these issues, to what extent is the federal government visible and making a difference? Because I think there's plenty of blame to go around. Let me just put it that way of where we are right now. But I think it's disconnected and it's very siloed, and people don't have an understanding of, well, I don't know what is exactly a local responsibility versus like what is the state doing here. And we're my colleagues and I are doing a lot more at the state level actually at the moment, because it's the state is very much a black box in a lot of cases, where you can look at a place like North Carolina, for example, can be very different from Virginia, which can be very different from South Carolina, which every state is very different, because our challenges are very fragmented, they're very localized, and there's different sort of politics and histories and trajectories and starting points
Right.
for these issues. So I would say, yeah, I mean, to what extent the local leaders are doing this is important, but I also wouldn't ignore what state leaders are doing as well.
How can the media, whether it's social or the larger media, national media, what can they do to make this more urgent? Because I think a lot of times just what you say is true. The bridge fell, or the water is toxic or whatever. It's never these things work together, and here's what you get when they fail together. It's a systemic failure. How can the media do a better job, or even each of us, because now we each are a media source because of social media. How can we all do a better job of pushing the button on modernization of our cities, just so, whether it's, I mean, like you said before, sustainable, more healthy, just peace of mind and physical health, mental health. I mean, all that works together, because when cities fail, all these things get affected. So what are some things that the media and each of us can be doing to change the message?
Yeah, what I like to say, Eric, is infrastructure policy isn't just like on its own island, right? Like where it's like, well, let's just do infrastructure over here and then like do everything else. Like infrastructure policy is economic policy, is climate policy. It's all intertwined, it's all interconnected. And so to the extent that like we're just talking about transportation in isolation, we should be talking about transportation in light of like right? Like what are our climate challenges? Like what how are we handling land use? How are we talking about our water issues in terms of affordability and access? Like these are all intertwined. And I think, what I say is it shouldn't just, again, it shouldn't, where we started, it shouldn't just be a topic of conversation. Like, let's just let the engineers handle it. Like they've got all the specifications. They like know what they're doing with the projects. Like that's why we landed in this problem to begin with, is like, because we just think like we're doing the same old thing and it's not really working well. And so to the extent that infrastructure is part of the sort of the dialogue of all these issues is really important. And to the extent that it's intuitive and it's kind of easily relatable to people, when you're like having a struggle getting to work, or you run into a jam traffic, to get to a concert or something, or your kids can't, again, I mentioned before, like your kids can't get internet at home because you can't afford, like these are all connected to infrastructure, whether we realize it or not. And so to the extent that people can, I think, recognize that, not, I'd be happy if they read one of my reports or but I realize most people do not read reports and download stuff like that. They
Well,
go
hold
to
on a second. Let's give people a chance, Joe. So if you have a website address or something like that, why don't you read it real fast?
Yeah, so brookings.edu, and if you search my name, so Joe Kane, Kane, you'll find a bunch of stuff on infrastructure. It's all free. It's all available for download if you want to wonk out on this stuff. But I'll say, the reality of our information landscape, as you know, Eric, I mean, a lot of people get their information from TikTok or from Instagram or from any number of sources now. So I'm not saying like infrastructure is going to go viral on TikTok, but how do you try to relate some of the issues we're talking about of not just like the negative stories and the frustrations, but hopefully some of the positive stories too? Like, how do you convey that to a broader audience so that they care about it? And I think in a positive way, we do see that, especially among younger listeners or younger viewers, like passion around certain climate issues, for example. Like I think we've seen increased interest in like, hey, that if they're passionate about solving certain climate issues, that's connected to how we do our transportation. Like that's connected to how we do our water issues. So it's like I think we are already seeing some of that, but it's incumbent on not just researchers like me, but you as well, Eric, and everyone to be, I guess, opening a TikTok account and getting the word out.
Joe, we're going to have to go, and that's really true. And I think this idea of connecting the dots for folks around how all of these issues, whether it's water or broadband, it all comes back to equity and sustainability. And I think we have to start thinking about modernizing our society. And I'll just give a hint, but it's not just infrastructure. We need to modernize a lot of our policies about our workforce and poverty levels and housing and all these things. We're just working in systems that are very, very old. But that's a whole other topic. But Joe, I want to say thank you very much, and everybody, thanks for listening. Have a great day.